Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Youth Care Podcast. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Dr. Linda Kotler. Dr. Kotler, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Hi, Oliver. Thank you for having me today. So I am a professor of epidemiology here at the University of Florida. And I'm the Associate Dean for Research in the College of Public Health and Health Professions. And our department is unique. We're in both the College of Public Health and Health Professions and we're in the College of Medicine.
Yeah, that is certainly an interesting position and also an interesting overlap in terms of research. And I think often we underestimate the importance of epidemiology when it comes to being a practicing professional or practicing healthcare provider when we are kind of out there battling on the front lines. In regards to your current position and what you are doing, reflecting on how you got into your current position, what got you initially interested in epidemiology and especially in the field of addiction research?
Well, I think for a lot of people in our field, serendipity has played a major role. I think in my life, if I think about it, I met my husband serendipitously as a next door neighbor. And so I was living in St. Louis and I was a nurse and I wanted to do something else. And so I took a map of the United States and I threw a dart at the map and it came out to the East Coast around the Boston area. So I packed up my stuff and I moved to Boston. And that whole story in itself is an interesting serendipitous story, but anyway, over the next few weeks when I got a job at the Boston Lying In, the Boston Floating Hospital, part of Tufts New England Medical Center, I was working in the ICU and I was reading the newspaper and I saw that there was an ad for an epidemiologist. And I had no idea what that was. And so I applied, I wrote a handwritten letter to the person. And because I was from St. Louis, he had gone to Washington University for his undergrad degree. And he said, well, at least I have to interview this person who's from St. Louis. So that's how I got started in epidemiology.
That is...
Yeah, it was really funny. And it was, and they were, what they were doing was so exciting. They were looking at the side effects of drugs for the PDR, the physician desk reference. And so I would go to do rounds with physicians and I would listen in to see if there was anything in the pediatric rounds that said, like, this child had suffered from a side effect of the drug, so then I would have to report it. And then soon after, which is now the Sloan Epidemiology Unit in Boston, at Boston University. And so I learned epidemiology from the best people in the field. Dennis Sloan and Sid Shapiro, Alan Mitchell, they were just fabulous mentors and taught me everything I needed to know about case control studies and epidemiology, and really got me interested to go ahead and make sure that I could get involved in the academic part of it. I eventually got my master's in public health from Boston University School of Public Health in their evening and weekend program.
So it's kind of interesting how sometimes serendipity, as it was the case for you, got you interested in a new research field, completely different from what you potentially originally planned out. You know, we all have these ideas where we think our life might go when we go into a profession. And, I thought I would be a pharmacist and, work in a retail pharmacy. And here I am somewhere in Germany. I'm originally from Germany. So kind of interesting where life can take you down the road. But once you got into the field of epidemiology and you were basically working really, I mean, at that time, I would imagine epidemiology looked different from how it looks today, considering what we know and what kind of tools we utilize today in terms of technology that supports us in collecting data, but also getting the input from physicians and from other healthcare providers when it comes to collecting adverse outcomes or when it comes to substance use disorders. Can we now actually look much more closely at incidence and prevalence of disorders or substance use disorders for that particular when we hone in kind of on what U of Care is interested in?
Well, sure. I mean, now there's big data sets. There's, you know, millions and millions of lives that you can look at, and you can see what's happening in the medical record, and you don't have to have a person going around and listening to see if there's a side effect. You can actually look for those signals in the big data. But what I learned really were the basics. I learned the observational aspects. I think everything I learned from being a nurse. But then, you know, moving on from there was another serendipitous moment where I, at Boston University, I was after I graduated, and I was working at the Sloan Epidemiology Unit. Then I had met I had heard that one of my faculty at BU, School of Public Health, she wanted to let me know about a particular position at Washington University. And it was to coordinate a very large study on psychiatric disorders. And she knew that I was from St. Louis, and Washington University was one of the five sites. So I was home for a visit in the summer, and I met my new-to-be boss, who was Lee Robbins, world-renowned psychiatric epidemiologist. And she hired me to come back to St. Louis and to coordinate this study for the St. Louis area. And I remember, you know, being so excited about it. I forgot to ask her, like, what my salary was going to be and things like that. But I was married at the time. We had a little girl, and we moved back to St. Louis. And that was a terrific opportunity for me. It was the first time that we knew anything about psychiatric disorders in the population. So at five different sites around the country, we were, you know, going out with interviewers, and we were doing multi-stage probability sampling, and we were looking at the prevalence and the incidence of psychiatric disorders for the first time, because Jimmy Carter's wife, Rosalind, she asked her husband, what do we know about psychiatric disorders and the treatment? And he said, we don't really know anything. And so that's when he decided to start this epidemiologic catchment area study. And from there, so we had assessments. We had to develop the assessments that would be used by non-clinicians to make to gather the information that we could use to make psychiatric diagnoses. And for the first time, we got information about comorbidity you know, the duration of symptoms and the type of symptoms. And, of course, at the time, the American Psychiatric Association had just come out with their standardized third edition of Psychiatric Disorders Manual. And so we did have a Bible, a pathway to look for these criteria, but they hadn't been placed in a sort of a way that people could actually ask someone a question about their symptoms and their severity. So it was so exciting to be part of this opportunity, and it was a landmark study. And so I learned so much from that study, because we had a research firm that we were working with. And so I got to learn all the tools about recruitment and retention and all of those things that you really have to roll up your sleeves and you have to know. And it's then, you know, not only do you become the observer of these firms and while they're doing it, but then you eventually become very skillful in your own work and you can train other people how to do things like that. So that was a really beginning for me, a very exciting piece of my life and career. And in that time, it's when I really got interested in the particular area of substance use and abuse. I mean, I was in the cohort where, when, you know, there was the Vietnam War, there were drugs coming on the scene, and it was just very, I was very curious about knowing what was going on with the trajectory of people who were using. So I really got very interested, and I really carved out that niche for myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, especially when it comes to psychiatric disorders, and when you were right there on the front lines of actually looking at the first epidemiological landscape, kind of scaping that out, what does it look like in the United States in terms of comorbidities? We know now, at least to some degree, that there seems to be an association between psychiatric disorders and substance use disorders for at least some substances. How at the time discovering that and building on that, what was kind of your perception of how, where this would go in the long run, and how would it affect society overall? Would it typecast? Would it potentially lead to, you know, kind of creating this kind of mindset of people being put into a particular category? Substance use disorder leads to, or, you know, these associations mm-hmm. that can lead to cause and effect, or anything like that?
Those are interesting questions. And so the day that I showed up for my job in 1980, my boss, Lee Robbins, she said to me, I'm sure that you're probably going to want to get your PhD. And I mean, I hadn't thought about that ever. And so, mm-hmm. She is a sociologist, and she said, you know, you could get your degree in sociology with a focus on psychiatric epidemiology. And since I'm your boss, and, you know, I could be your mentor. And so, so I started right there. The day that I came to work, I started to, you know, think about that, and I applied, and I started in November, and in that spring I started my PhD, and my PhD was really focusing on the comorbidity of sedative use and psychiatric disorders. And I had this wonderful data set to look at and to utilize, even though all the data hadn't been collected yet. But all of us at these five sites, they all had the, you know, the principal investigators, and they had the what people called the second stringers. Those were like the second generation. That was us. We were, you know, a lot of us were together, and we're still colleagues today, and we still work together. And some of us are still even publishing from the ECA data set. But all of these things were brand new. We were learning about the proper way to look at prevalence and the way to look at incidence, and how would we deal with these nosological issues as the criteria changed? What would we do about operationalization of the criteria? How would we decide on these symptoms that were part of one diagnosis, but were also actually attributed to another, like antisocial personality disorder and substance use disorder? And there were disorders that, and criteria and behaviors that some of the other sites, you know, some sites wanted to ask and some sites didn't. So our site was very much interested in some additional foci for antisocial personality disorder, where others were more interested in panic disorder, and we were interested in post-traumatic stress disorder. And then the whole, you know, disorder, there were there's conditional disorders. So some disorders, you can have, like depression, you can have, and it's not conditional on something else, but a post-traumatic stress disorder is conditional on an exposure and on an event. And so those were other issues that we had to think about. What are the risk factors for exposure, and what's the risk factors for the trajectory to having a disorder? And the same with gambling disorder. That was just starting to be talked about at the time. People thought it was an impulse control disorder. Now in the DSM-5, the fifth edition of these psychiatric conditions, it's listed as an addiction with use disorder, like those behaviors. So we're thinking more in terms of how all of these data that we collected back in the 1980s helped us to really understand more about the behaviors and the disorder, what's conditional, what's a standalone disorder, and what about the comorbidities, as well as, you know, what comes first? How do these disorders present themselves? Do you have one before the other? Is that a condition that you, like, do you get depressed before you use drugs? Or are you self-medicating? These are some of the really, these are issues that are still, we're still thinking about today.
Yeah, and I guess to some degree there's like the chicken and the egg problem in regards to, can you actually generalize it? Can you make a generalized claim about, is one individual potentially using, developing a substance use disorder and then subsequently developing a depressive or an anxiety depressive disorder? Or, you know, can you actually have a cause and effect, or can it also flip around?
Yeah, and some of this, then we got into, you know, thinking, okay, we've now laid the groundwork. So we now have tools that we can use to ask people about their symptoms. Because that's the first step, right? There is no blood test that tells you that you have antisocial personality disorder. There's no blood test that tells you that you have most anything in psychiatry. But you really have to know the questions, what questions to ask. And I still feel that even now, there are people who really still get excited about the basics. I'm one of those people who still get excited, because no matter what the technology is, you still have to know how to, the predictive model has to still fall back on what's the essence of that particular thing that you're going to call meeting the threshold, whether it's a disorder or whether it's mild, moderate, severe. You have to base those on the things that happen to people, and those are things that we have to know. So I'm very interested in the art of asking questions, so that no matter what tools we have, no matter how much we know about the brain and the magnet that we put people into to find out what's going on in the brain, unless you know what the conditions are that the people are experiencing right now, you don't know what that brain signal means. And so I love the fact that I can help people with the art of asking questions, and the whole issue of assessment. And should you ask, if you already have a baseline, should you just move on from there to ask people, well, since we last spoke to you, do you have this? And then adding those things up over their lifetime, or looking at the past 12 months, looking at past 30 days. I mean, these are all things that are still major issues in our field. And I feel lucky to be an epidemiologist, because we will always have these questions come up.
Yeah, I think that in regards to epidemiology in general, when we think of as healthcare providers, or as the general population, I mentioned at the beginning, epidemiology is sometimes a little bit underappreciated. I feel that when we look at you know, our general practice, and we look at the value of current data that we are putting out there in terms of epidemiological data, and how it benefits us, helps us as healthcare providers in current treatment and also in future projection of helping patients. What do you think, as an epidemiologist, as somebody who has used, who has developed, who has contributed to the field of epidemiology, what do you think are the major benefits and the major challenges when it comes to epidemiology that healthcare providers should be aware of moving forward?
Well, epidemiologists and physicians who take a history have a lot in common. So when that physician or the healthcare provider goes in, you know, still what they still do, they go in and they talk to patients, they talk to people. They're still asking them questions like, tell me what happened, you know, tell me what's the matter, why are you here today? And they go into, well, did you think, like, what's your history? And I mean, they're doing one of these epidemiological investigations. And I think that as epidemiologists, we can help physicians more readily hone in on those questions that they would like to ask, so that we can help them to standardize more their history taking. Because if you put 10 residents or even physicians in a room and you ask them how would they find out about X, you'll get 10 different ways of getting it. And so one of the things these standardized assessment tools have done is helped to teach physicians and residents what the criteria are, what are some best practices, best practice ways of asking those questions. So I think we can help them there. The other thing I think we can help do is to talk about the social determinants of health, that many times we are doing a history and we're talking about the exact condition, but we're not asking them about the other things that have led up to those conditions, and the risks for them, or their employment, their stressors, their family, their besides their occupation, or their food insecurity. These are things that can make a big difference in this, in their behaviors, their condition, and their diagnosis that we don't really focus on enough. One of the reasons we don't focus enough is because it takes a long time to ask these questions. But if we found a way that we could quickly get a history from people about those social determinants, we could then help the physician and the care provider to give the referrals that they need and keep some people out of the system that don't really need to be in the system. For example, the emergency department, or other places where there are high utilizers, but it's because they don't have access any other way, or because they're really looking for some other type of care besides, you know, their respiratory infection. They really do want to speak with a social worker. They really do want to speak with a nurse, someone else who can help to get them to a food pantry, someone who could help to alleviate some of the suffering from some other things besides the reason that they presented to the emergency department. So I think that's how we can help the physicians in the system with a place for us to put those pieces of information into the medical record so they wouldn't end up in what's called the junk drawer of the medical record. That really nobody goes to because they just think of it as superfluous information.
Okay, that is, I think that is very helpful. And I think it really points to the more, I don't want to call it holistic, but I think it is actually, because holistic has a certain attachment you know, a certain other attachment that we attach to it, or at least meaning. But I think it is a little bit more of a holistic patient approach of treating the whole patient instead mm-hmm. of just classifying them or associating them with a certain diagnosis and then moving on, basically, like a little bit of a factory process, which we are, as healthcare providers, sometimes not only used to, but also pressured into because of the way that our healthcare system is set up in a certain manner. But we can potentially optimize it by actually reducing the workload on certain stress factors on certain systems, like you said, like the ED or critical care facilities. So I think that is something that we might want to consider. So let me ask then, in regards to the current developments, and we have seen various epidemics emerge in regards to substance use disorders, like the meth epidemic, the opioid epidemic that have emerged. And we always call it an epidemic because it kind of is a media hype. But how do you consider that within the setting of an epidemiological research term, or within looking at it from a research perspective?
Well, when I was in St. Louis and I was working with the ECA study, then around after I got my PhD in 1987, then I applied for my first grant. And at the time, there was a cocaine epidemic. And so for a decade, I was studying and looking at cocaine use and abuse and dependence. And I got my first grant in 1989 from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I've been continuously funded by NIDA since that time. So I'm really lucky, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful career. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse has been a great source of support for me, and it's been very helpful to all of the people that I have had the privilege to do research with. So I've looked at community-based work. All of my studies have been community-based. I have worked with women and men in St. Louis. I've worked with people all over the world through the WHO. I've been able to work with NFL players and their use of drugs, pain medications. I've done interventions, especially to reduce their high-risk behaviors for HIV. So there are these epidemics that come along, and they are attributed to one another. So HIV and cocaine, and then all of a sudden, then cocaine sort of dies down, and then we have the opioid epidemic. And so I've also worked with people in the justice system. So in the criminal justice system, justice involved women. And then in 2011, I was recruited here to the University of Florida. So I'm very happy to be here working with people in Florida, the third most populous state in the country, where there is a lot of need. But one of the things that has been stable in my life has been a community engagement program that I started called Health Street. And we started in St. Louis, and it's really to connect people to medical and social services. And then it melded into an opportunity to give people opportunities to hear about research. So we have community health workers out every day in the community talking to people where they live and work and play. And we assess people for their needs and concerns. And then we link them to these different referral services, medical and social services. We're linked to our IRB, and so we know all the studies that are going on at the University of Florida. And we can link people to those studies and those investigators as well, so that they can have more diverse populations in their studies. We are really working with the underrepresented population, people who have disabilities, people who use drugs, people who are older, people who are women who are pregnant, people who are minority, people who are in rural areas. They don't have opportunities necessarily to hear about research. And so studies and treatments are developed without hearing the voice of everybody. So my job, my passion is to really give everyone a voice in research. And so we've been working with Health Street now since 1989. It's really going well here in Florida. We have about 12,000 people in our cohort, and we're increasing the cohort every day. But I feel this passion to work with people to help them to be able to give them the opportunities that other people have. And that's where we look at these epidemics as well. We see people who are using opioids. And what we're trying to do in the community is really get the word out about the overdose crisis. And if someone says that they've used prescription pain medicines in their life, we have these Deterra bags, these deactivation pouches that we give people so that they could take the medications in their bathrooms, wherever they are. And if they're expired or they're not using them anymore, they can throw them in the bag. They put some water in the bag, they shake it up, and they can deactivate the pills. The medication is deactivated, and they can throw this away in an environmentally safe way, right in the trash. And it will help to alleviate some of this diversion that's going on, where people are stealing drugs in people's homes, where people are using drugs that don't belong to them. We're just kind of getting rid of some of those things. And we're also working with our state Department of Health to distribute naloxone, Narcan, the nasal spray mist. So we're teaching people how to use it out in the community. We're giving them, a dose or two so that they can have it on hand in case they see someone who's overdosing. Really, we're trying desperately to find ways that we can connect with people and teach them how to be part of the solution in the community. So that's one of the things we're doing with our community engagement program, but it's interesting, Oliver, because I'm using some of those basic connections that I used from the ECA study to how to recruit people, how to retain them, and it's incredible. And I know you've talked with Sarah Jo Nixon about the ABCD study, and I'm involved in that as well with Sarah Jo. She and I are partners in that study, and I know you've spoken to Lori Nackstedt, and she and I are partners in the back translational work. So it's really interesting to partner with someone who's doing the other spectrum of research in drug abuse. She's looking at the rodent model, but she doesn't quite know like what drugs to give or how to give the rodents the drugs that people are using every day. So we're doing this back translational model where we're interviewing the people in the community to find out what their most common patterns are of drug use, so that we'll be able to then tell her, these are the four or five most common ways and patterns that people are using cocaine and alcohol and marijuana, and see what happens if you give it like this to the rodents and see if they have some of the similar problems in their cages that people express having. And so that's just a really terrific opportunity for us all now.
Yeah, I think your community efforts and obviously Health Street is something that has grown into this incredible model, really outstanding model that is kind of, to my knowledge, I think a few other states, I don't know if it's on a state basis, but I think it has been tried to be reproduced by others as well, from what I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, we're around the state. Yeah, so we're going around the state. We have Health Street in Bangkok, Thailand, and we have a couple of other places around the country that are trying to utilize our methods. So it's really, really great.
Yeah, yeah, because it's both an outreach effort and also enables you as a researcher to actually collect data at the same time. So it's benefiting the community and it's benefiting you as a research team because you're kind of getting the latest input, the latest data information, while at the same time also benefiting the community by providing outreach, information, knowledge, and providing trying Narcan prevention methods. So I think it really is mutually beneficial to everybody involved. When we talk about like the differences, and I think that's where we're still reaching our kind of our full capacity threshold is when we try to translate something from an animal model to the human condition, we have this huge barrier where behavior is something that we simply cannot model adequately in an animal. We can try to kind of play around a little bit with it by trying to interpret certain behaviors, but it's simply, I don't think that we, at this point at least, who knows what happens in the future, but we cannot really model or directly reproduce the complexity of human behavior in an animal. And I think that's where some of the back translation is simply not entirely possible, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. No, you're right.
From what I remember from the Vietnam experiment that you mentioned much earlier is that there was kind of the expectation that a lot of people would come back with an opioid addiction, potentially a heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. Actually, a number of people were coming back and were not addicted to heroin because of coming back into a social environment where they were simply not necessarily, that was completely different from where they were in Vietnam. And so they did not require the drug. And that kind of had an impact on how we actually, the paradigm that we used in some of the animal models as well, in terms of social exposure, and kind of changed our understanding from how I understand it, how we saw the social impact on drug use, right?
That's right. That was my mentor, Lee Robbins. She worked on that study with other people in Washington, D.C., and it was something that they were very, very surprised about. So it's like I saw her trajectory in her career, how she serendipitously was involved in so many important landmark opportunities. And the same thing has happened to me. I've been really fortunate to be involved in several major landmark studies. And I really feel so lucky and privileged to be able to work with the people that I'm working with and then pass it on to the next generation. And that's why I really like I really love mentoring, and I really like being a training director for the National Institute of Drug Abuse and have a what we call a T32, a training grant, because we can have such an impact beyond what we do every day by sharing our knowledge and our tools and our idiosyncrasy about how to do certain things with the next generation. And they share to us, so it's bi-directional too. We're always learning new techniques and we're trying to share our techniques with them. So it's always what I'm considering this back to basics thing, where there's always a new test, there's always a new tool, and there's always a new you know, statistical test to do. And yet if people don't understand the basics, what are the basic rates of this illness? What are the basic fundamentals? I think that's the thing that we have to remember to train forever.
Wonderful. Any parting words or anything that I think this was already a very good kind of, you know, you kind of pass on to the next generation your wisdom, and you're willing to share. But any parting words, anything that you think is kind of the most important lessons that you have learned from.
Well, Oliver, you've been wonderful this morning to, you know, with this podcast. You've really brought out some very interesting pieces of my life, and I appreciate that. And I think that that my mother taught me something that I always say, and that is, you take yourself with you wherever you go, so that, you know, whatever your interests are, whatever your curiosities are, you're going to be curious about this and that and the other thing, and you're always, you know, going to take that with you. And my mentor, Lee Robbins, taught me that if something doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. And I really appreciated thinking about that throughout my life, because there have been so many times when people have seen something on the data that said, well, that's what the data said. I mean, it's significant. But it didn't seem right. And it was because only after looking, maybe they coded it incorrectly. Maybe they hadn't really thought about something else. But it's always important to go the extra step and to really think things through, because a lot of times, if something doesn't seem right, it probably is because it's not. And it's sometimes also because people don't roll up their sleeves and you know, know what they're asking other people to do. Don't go so far. Don't be the ivory tower person who never really had to do the work themselves. Get involved from every step so you know what it is. That's really my parting words, is a big thank you to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing your incredible work and your incredible, I don't want to call it a story, because what it really is all of your research that you have done over at least 30, 40 years, I would say by now, right? So it is an incredible career and sometimes you are walking down a path that you have never seen before, that is just opening up by serendipity, as you mentioned in the beginning, and it's incredible where it can take you. That's something that I think I learned early on in life as well. So, and it's amazing where it can take you. So,
yeah, it is. If it's fun, it's got to be epi.
Yes, exactly.
That's what people say.
That's the adventure of life, and you should be ready for sometimes roller coaster and turns and wherever it might take you. You never know. So thank you very much, Dr. Kotler, again, for taking the time today. And thank you very much to everybody for listening. We will have a new podcast episode coming up. So stay tuned for that. Thank you, Dr. Kotler.
Thank you.